Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm Tom Michael. I'm general manager of Boise State Public Radio, and community conversations like these are a hallmark of public radio. We are pleased to be partnering with HuffPost on this event, and in less than a month, voters will decide on Proposition 2 here in Idaho. But here to talk more about the Listen to America tour is the executive editor of HuffPost. Please join me in welcoming Hillary Fry.
Thank you. Thanks everybody for being here tonight, and thanks so much to Boise State Public Radio for partnering with us on this event. This is most of our first time in Boise, and we've all decided we're moving here. So, and we've been here for about 4 hours. So we were sold on the green belt, and now you have us. So I'll be back. Thank you. So I just wanted to give a little context about what we're doing here before we start our panel. We're here as part of our Listen to America project. This year, what we're doing with Listen to America, we're out on the road, a handful of us from HuffPost, for 2 weeks. We're visiting 5 Western states, 6 cities, and we're doing events like this everywhere we go. So we've already been to San Diego, Sacramento, and Reno. We next go to Boulder, and then we'll be in Phoenix. And we're talking about everything from policing and accountability to women in politics to school choice and affordable housing. And on that point, when you came in, you were probably given a couple of things to fill out. So I think Tiana probably gave you some context on this, but you have a postcard from us that's for a project we're doing about affordable housing. We're trying to understand the challenges people face where they live across the country. Last year, when we did a Listen to America project, we were on the road for 7 weeks. We visited 25 cities. We interviewed more than 1,700 people. And one common thing we heard almost every place we were was that there is a housing crisis in this country. So if you can help us out and fill out that postcard, it would be awesome. You also have a short survey from our partners that I'm sure they would be grateful if you filled that out too. And with that, I'm gonna hand it over to James, our moderator for this evening. James Watson is a reporter at Boise State Public Radio, and he will introduce your panel. Thank you.
Hey, good evening, everyone.
I'm sorry. Hold on. Oh. Turn me on again. James Dawson. I'm sorry, I didn't write it down because I thought this would be on, so I apologize.
No, totally
Thank
fine.
You.
Totally fine. Good evening. I'm James Dawson. I'm a reporter here at Boise State Public Radio. We've got, obviously, 4 panelists up here tonight. And when we were brainstorming with HuffPost about what kind of issues we thought might resonate with Idahoans and people across really the nation, Medicaid came up almost immediately. We gravitated towards that pretty quickly. Right now, up to 91,000 Idahoans could qualify for Medicaid if Proposition 2 passes next month. And most of those people fall into what's called the Medicaid gap. I'm sure most of you have heard about this in our coverage, not to mention the coverage of every other media outlet in the state of Idaho, but the Medicaid gap is someone who falls into the Medicaid gap is a person who does not make enough to qualify for a health insurance subsidy through the federal health insurance exchange, or they make too much to qualify for Medicaid under current Idaho law. So this campaign has been historic since it's one of the first initiatives to actually qualify for the ballot since the state legislature changed those rules in 2013. But it's also part of a trend in conservative states where people are taking this issue to the ballot box. And so with me tonight on this panel, we have a few folks. We have to my direct left here, Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior correspondent at our partner HuffPost, and also author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis. We have to his left, Representative John Vanderwoude, who serves as Majority Caucus Chair for the Idaho House of Representatives, and also serves on the House Health and Welfare Committee. To his left, we have Brian Whitlock, who is the President of the Idaho Hospital Association. Do I have that correctly? Great. And he has served in these kinds of positions for over 30 years and has been with the Hospital Association since 2015, if I remember correctly. Great. And then we have Donna Scranton, who's a Boise resident, who she lived in the Gap for 3 years. She recently, just as of about a couple weeks ago, just recently got healthcare coverage, but was in the Gap for 3 years. She has an unidentified neurological condition that doctors haven't really been able to pin down, and she was on a waiting list to qualify since she wasn't able to as a single woman under 65. And so those, she would have been, if Prop 2 passes, she would have been immediately eligible for Medicaid coverage as well. So for some ground rules, we will split our time about evenly between our panel and audience questions. And when we do transition into those questions from you, Hillary from HuffPost will be running the microphone. So if you see her and you have a question, just kind of give a shout, give a little wave. And also, I know this is a sensitive issue for a lot of people on both sides of the issue, so be civil and also be brief so we can get to as many questions as possible. And if you hear someone else ask a similar question, try to avoid any repeats, maybe come up with, you know, a couple, three questions that you might want to ask, and we'll go from there. And as moderator, I do reserve the right to ask follow-up questions if they come up. So yeah, let's go ahead and get right into it. There's a little bit of backstory here that's interesting. So in 2012, a panel convened by Governor Butch Otter unanimously recommended expanding Medicaid eligibility, but instead state lawmakers chose to open its own state-based insurance exchange after a bitter debate. And a similar panel also urged state lawmakers to expand Medicaid 2 years later. So I suppose I'll pose this to you, Representative Vanderwoude. Why did the Idaho legislature punt on those recommendations?
There wasn't enough consensus on what the Medicaid expansion was going to look like and what kind of sideboards we wanted on it. And so there were a couple of times I proposed different legislation that I did at one time, get it through the House, was not able, well, I got it to the Senate and they changed it all around, which then made it unacceptable to the House. So in all of politics, it requires compromise. You have to be able to work on both sides. And the difficulty was, is there was a bunch of them dead set absolutely against it, and some of them dead set in favor. And to reach a consensus within the legislature is not as easy as you think. Even though Idaho is largely Republican, we don't all think the same. And I think the legislature has, in some instances, has gone farther to the right with a group of people that has made it even harder to come up with a solution that is acceptable to a majority of the House members.
Well, maybe talk about that a bit more and kind of go into it. What are the sticking points that people in the Republican caucus are kind of bitterly opposed and divided over in this specific debate?
I think a large part of it is more dependent on the federal government than what we are already. And even the governor has asked, you know, all the agencies to take a look at where their money is coming from the federal government and how they would wean themselves off of the federal government's money in case the federal government started making cuts because they're spending more money than they have. And so it's been, you know, to expand and then start taking more federal dollars than what we currently already have, I think, is probably one of the bigger sticklers. And to make the government more in charge of healthcare. I think that's the wrong direction for a lot of legislators, is that healthcare needs to be more back to the person who is receiving it than the government that's providing it.
So right now, the current system, counties in the state both have programs that help cover health insurance costs for those folks who are uninsured. And between the two of them, they've paid out tens of millions of dollars every year to cover these bills. So, Representative, how do you think the system is working currently as it stands?
Not very well. We also have a high risk pool that the state put in to cover people with certain conditions. To take care of people after a catastrophic event is not what healthcare should be. And that was one of the things that I tried to do with the legislation that I tried to pass, was at least start providing some type of primary care to the people before it becomes a catastrophic event. Now what we do is we wait until it's a catastrophic event. They go to the hospital, to my good friend here, and they get a bill that's way higher than what they can afford. And then we start negotiating on how much the state's going to pay and who's going to pay and stuff like that. That's not how you deliver good health care. You have to start figuring out where do you get enough primary care to avoid the catastrophic. And that was part of what I had proposed at that time, was some type of primary care model to at least start providing care so that we have less catastrophic care. Now we're just dealing with after the fact, what now, what do we do, rather than before the fact.
Yeah, Brian, maybe talk about that from the hospital's perspective. What are you seeing on the provider side?
Sure, and let me just echo what the representative said. And I think the issue really did boil down to cost in the legislature. I think there are some that are concerned that it would cost too much for the state to provide Medicaid expansion to uninsured in Idaho. And at the same time, you had folks who looked at some of the proposals that were being offered and looked at the cost of those and said, this is only a partial solution and only addresses a small segment of the population, and it costs just as much as full expansion, or nearly just as much as full expansion. So this issue of cost really caused a back and forth in the legislature, which resulted in not being able to reach a consensus. In the meantime, you do have these people that reach this healthcare crisis point where they haven't had the preventive care leading up to a health crisis. So rather than a system that provides a diabetic with insulin, they're missing those insulin shots, and they come to us when it's time for a limb amputation. And the cost then gets passed on to the taxpayer through the catastrophic health care fund, through the indigent fund. Hospitals can't absorb all of that, so those costs get shifted to those who are insured. And so you see, we're already paying for it in a variety of ways, in the most inefficient way, and I think the people of Idaho last year said there's got to be a better way. And you saw a citizens' grassroots effort that just sprouted up all around the state to gather signatures to put this on the ballot and to help in this difficult decision. I mean, I totally get what the representative was talking about in terms of the difficulty in reaching consensus, but I think come November 6th, Idahoans will speak on this issue and they will send a loud and clear message to the legislature that there is a path forward, there is a way to address the uninsured in Idaho, and they will be saying yes to Proposition 2. When they do that, that will take some of this uncompensated care that hospitals ultimately end up providing through charity care or bad debt, and it will find a way to infuse money back into those rural economies around the state. And they won't be relying on the taxpayers with local property taxes to cover those expensive bills. Instead, it will be done in a more efficient way through Medicaid expansion.
Jonathan, maybe talk a little bit about the national perspective here. Back when the Affordable Care Act did pass and states were just considering expanding Medicaid, what was kind of the national conversation at that time across the country?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing here is that when they wrote the Affordable Care Act, there wasn't supposed to be a national conversation about this. The people who wrote the law, the idea was to make sure everybody could have health insurance. And the decision was made that for low-income people, people at the poverty line or just above the poverty line, the easiest and actually most cost-effective way to do that was to get everybody into Medicaid. And that was the assumption. You may remember there was that Supreme Court case in 2012 which challenged the individual mandate, and the sort of sleeper issue in that was the court kind of came in and to everybody's surprise, came out and said, hey, by the way, states, you really don't have to expand Medicaid if you don't want to. And that, like I said, took everybody by surprise. And suddenly we were having 51, including the District of Columbia, different debates, should we expand Medicaid? And it sort of, because the politics of Obamacare were so polarized, it immediately divided the country in exactly the way you would expect. And so with one or two exceptions, you had the blue states, California, Maryland, New England, were quick to expand. States where you had Republicans in charge of more conservative wanted nothing to do with it. And then there was sort of a middle group of states where you had, which were, they correspond roughly to the swing states of the electorate. I live in one of them, Michigan, where we have Democratic senators and a Republican governor. And they kind of, you know, they tended to look at it in a slightly less partisan lens, or at least there was more of a divided opinion. And what we've seen happen gradually is those states have come on board. They have all made the decision one by one to do this. Michigan has expanded, Ohio has expanded, Arizona, and these are all states with Republican governors and in many cases Republican legislatures. And now the states left are mostly states where you have Republicans in charge who make the same arguments. You know, they worry that this is too much government, that it will cost the state too much money, that it absolves people of personal responsibility, and that is where the conversation is now.
We've talked a bit about the 40,000-foot view of what expanding Medicaid could mean here in just the few minutes that we've already started here, but let's zoom in a little. Donna, tell us a little bit about your story and what it was like living in the gap for almost 3 years.
I became ill about a little over 5 years ago. I was working as a behavioral therapist. After a couple of years of working with this debilitating disease, my employer had to let me go. I was then put on disability, Social Security disability, and I questioned my medical insurance because obviously I'm not employed anymore, so I don't have it. And Social Security told me as soon as you're approved, you go to health and welfare and you'll get Medicaid. That was not the case. So I have an undiagnosed neurological disorder, and I do apologize if I have a episode up here. So anyway, I need to see a neurologist. I hadn't been able to. I finally found a sliding fee scale GP who would see me, but she obviously had her hands tied, didn't know what to do. Here I go, sorry. So. She tried to treat the symptoms, but without a neurologist involved, it's very difficult. Excuse me, 1 minute.
Yeah, no problem.
So the disease is progressing rapidly, not only do these spasms come into my face and my mouth to where I can't speak, but they also go into my neck where I'm being choked. They have moved into the right side of my body. They go into my legs. I can't stand for very long. And it's just scary to know that there's no place you can get medical attention. With the time it was choking me, my son took me to the emergency room, and there's belief that when you go into the emergency room and you're low income, that you can go on the indigent fund. You can if it's over $10,000. So I did the hardship application, and my $1,200 bill went to $859. That's not counting the physician fee, which was $500. As I said, I had a pretty good paying job as a behavioral therapist and went from that to $1,100 a month. That's not going to pay those type of fees. It's just not. I mean, I struggled just paying the sliding fee scale to see a GP, plus medications. My GP was insistent on a neurologist, and there was just no way. There was no way financially I could do that. So as you can see, it just progresses, and sometimes I can stop it, sometimes I can't, but it's just scary not knowing what you have, what your prognosis is, and where do you go for help.
Mm-hmm. So what's it been like since about 2 weeks ago you said that you finally got healthcare coverage? What was the first thing that you did?
October 1st, I actually saw my GP again. And October 3rd, I was at the neurologist. So.
How did it feel?
And that is a relief. That is a huge relief. Again, a lot of people believe that as soon as you go on Social Security disability, you're automatically on Medicare. Not the case. you have a 2.5-year waiting list. So they deem you disabled. They say you can't work, which obviously you can see that I can't. But then you can't go see a physician for 2.5 years. There's something wrong with that picture.
Well, Idaho isn't the only state in the country considering this. Jonathan, you've obviously been following healthcare policy for a long time. Catch us up on what's happening right now.
Healthcare, we have an election coming up, midterm election. And I think to the surprise of many people, not to me, this is what I do for a living, healthcare has become a very prominent issue. A lot of the attention is on this question of pre-existing conditions. Medicaid is equally an important issue in this election. You have 4 states, including Idaho, where there are ballot initiatives similar to this one, where basically the voters have said, look, we want to do something, we want to expand Medicaid, and we've the polling on these is who knows how accurate, but there seems to be substantial support for all 4 of these. In addition to that, and I think this hasn't gotten as much attention, in a number of states, control of the state legislature, the governor's seat is up. And if you look at some of these states like Georgia and Florida, states that have not expanded Medicaid, and you see the Democratic candidate running strongly on Medicaid expansion, there's a possibility that these states as well could expand. The flip side is control of the House and the Senate are very much in play. And again, I think this has not probably gotten the attention that it should, but in part because I think there's this expectation that Democrats are likely to take one House of Congress, but we don't know that. And if the Republicans keep control of both the House and the Senate, they have indicated they will once again try to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and that includes the money for the Medicaid expansion, and in fact, not just the money for the new expansion of Medicaid, but if you look at the bills that they proposed last year, those bills would have actually cut funds for existing Medicaid programs. So Medicaid is on the ballot, which is another way of saying that healthcare for many millions of people, like Donna, is on the ballot.
Have you noticed if Idaho's push differs much in tone or substance than the other 3 states where this is on the ballot?
I think the thing that's most striking about Idaho, and I don't know if this is because this is what we hear about Idaho, and I haven't been to every one of these states, and it may just be this green van, the green camper, which you guys have all seen, which is, very iconic. It has a very grassroots feel to it. I mean, these are all grassroots efforts, but it has a very organic feeling to it, which, perhaps is befitting the political moment of the time. I think there are a lot of very anxious people in this country, and, whether they are, whatever their view, and on both sides of the aisle, but people want to get something done, and so they're taking politics into their own hands.
And when you talk about expanding Medicaid through the ballot initiative process, you can't not talk about Maine. So Maine was the first state to approve a ballot initiative to expand Medicaid last year, but Governor Paula Page has refused to implement it. Kind of, what's going on there?
Well, that's exactly like you said. The voters said we want to have Medicaid expand. They voted to it. They passed the initiative, and Paula Page said, I'm not going to do it. He is basically refusing, and so they have taken him to court, and it's been going through the courts. My sense is that eventually it will happen. I mean, the voters spoke, it was passed, it's the law. He won't be governor forever. The courts will have their say. But I think, that is indicative that, with any of these plans, even the initiative is not always the end of the story. There can be litigation. And of course, once you expand Medicaid, you have to pay for it. And that is going to become part of the ongoing discussions, and obviously that's one of the things that's been a hang up here in the legislatures. There is most of the money for the expansion comes from the federal government, but there is a state share. It's small. Where does it come from? Can you make up for that with savings elsewhere? And that's the debate that I think was taking place in Idaho and in every legislature in the country.
If Proposition 2 passes, will the legislature respect the will of the voters, or will state lawmakers overrule them like they did in 2002 when they repealed the ballot initiative that imposed term limits.
I wasn't in the legislature in 2002. I came in 2006. And so I don't believe that the legislature will overturn the initiative if it passes. But I do believe that the legislature will have some serious discussions on what it looks like. What are the sideboards? What do we want to make it look like? In order that it doesn't, you know, gut the funding for the state for the other programs of the state. And so it's very careful. One thing I want to point out, a couple of things actually. You keep talking about a grassroots effort. You know, there was $500,000 that came in out of state money that came into Idaho to help create and get the petition signed. So it's not totally grassroots. It was people that gathered it there. And I respect the process. I think the legislature made the process more difficult, and they were able to overcome the difficulty of that and still get it on the ballot. And now it is at this point it is grassroots, because now it's going to be the voters that decide. And so, but we have, I believe when talking to other legislators, that if it passes, the legislature will do something with some type of sideboards. How much flexibility we have, I don't know. It may determine to CMS and what they're willing to allow us to do also.
Well, when you talk about sideboards, what does that mean in you know, pretty layman's terms?
Well, I think you've seen several different states have gone to CMS and asked for waivers or for exemptions and stuff like that, or work requirements or those type of things, I think, is what we're going to look at when we put on the when it gets to the legislature.
Even though some of those have been turned down by federal courts?
Well, you know, that's what I say. That's some of the things we're going to look at. What actually it's going to end up being, I don't know. That's going to be the legislative process, I believe.
So if it does fail, what kind of system should be in place in your mind? I mean, should a proposal to help some of those in the Medicaid gap, it couldn't even make it to the House floor this year, this specific proposal from Governor Butch Otter. It got out of committee, there was no debate on the House floor.
No, the dual waiver that the governor had, there were some issues with it. And I had talked to people. I was pretty close to signing on to that one with only one other requirement, and they didn't want to put that in there. And that was that if you qualify for the exchange and you decide not to buy insurance, then you're not eligible for the contingency fund and you're not eligible for the cap fund. In other words, if the state is going to provide you an opportunity to get insurance at virtually no cost or very little cost, and you decide not to, don't expect the state to pick up the tab. That was the one requirement that I had asked. If they put into that dual waiver program, then I would then support the program. They were not willing to put, the authors of that were not willing to put that in. And so, I mean, everybody has their own ideas of what they think it should look like, or where, you know, when will I, you know, vote for it and when will I vote against it. And every individual legislature has to decide that, even for their own district. And so personally, if it doesn't pass, we're not off the hook, in my opinion. I still think the legislature has to do something. There's a need out there that we need to create. Now, if we had $400 million a year, is this what we would do with it? I don't believe it is. I believe that we can create a better program for less money than $400 million. Now, granted, it's only going to cost us $40 because the federal government, but the whole cost of the program is still $400 million. And I think that's, and there's a lot of discussion in the legislature, well, this is free money, this money doesn't count. I don't know about anybody else, but I pay federal taxes just as well as I pay state taxes. It's still my money. And so it's not free money. It's money that's taken out of everybody's pockets. And so I think we can do better, but it's not going to be as some of the proposals I've had that have not been able to get all the way through is it's not enough. Well, you know, sometimes you got to start. Sometimes you got to move forward. You got to provide what you can and work with that. It's not a holistic solution every time.
Well, do you think that a compromise is possible, since this is, been in the legislature for several years, and nothing's really been done about it.
Well, you know, like I say, I got one bill through the House. That was a big push, but it had to have certain things in it to get certain people to go along with it. If it gets pushed too far, it dies again. That's just kind of that's the nature of politics. Everybody has to make their own decisions. And so eventually, I believe something will come out of it either way. There'll be more emphasis now and less opposition if the ballot initiative passes. I believe that at that point, the legislatures are going to say, we need to do the will of the people, and we need to get something done.
Well, Brian, oh, go ahead.
If I could just kind of jump in so that listeners understand what the process actually is. And in Idaho, a ballot initiative, upon passage, becomes law. So it doesn't have to go to the House and be passed and then die in the Senate. It is law. It is part of the Idaho code. It's part of statute. In fact, I joke that sometimes these initiatives are written statute-esque. They have to have that legal language so that it becomes part of Idaho code. And it's very clear. It's very prescriptive. It says that the state shall amend its state plan to expand Medicaid to certain persons. And so that's very prescriptive in the short ballot title. The issue then becomes, as Representative indicated, do you then tinker with that very prescriptive language? And I think the voters are going to say yes in a very strong way. Yes, we're going to have a discussion about work requirements, but the Department of Health and Welfare says that really only affects about 700 people in the state. And these are low-income working Idahoans who would qualify for Medicaid expansion. So I just hope we don't get wrapped around the axle come January about work requirements for low-income working Idahoans. And so, again, I think Idahoans will send a strong message on November 6th. We hope that the legislature will listen to that message, that there won't be that kind of tinkering. And really, then the question becomes, how do you come up with the money, the 10% match, to draw down the 90% match from the federal government? When I talk to people about this issue, I remind them that, again, these 62,000 uninsured Idahoans do have access to care. And sometimes it's at a point when it does reach a crisis, when it's the most expensive to treat, instead of giving them access to primary care and preventive care. And so we're already paying for it. Representative Anderwalda said he pays his federal taxes. I pay mine. You all paid yours. And 33 other states have expanded Medicaid, but Idaho has not. And by show of hands, did anybody get a refund or a rebate on their federal taxes because we did not take back our federal dollars? Yes, I'm a taxpayer. Yes, it affects what I pay in federal taxes. But 33 other states are taking advantage of a health care program to provide coverage to their uninsured. Idaho is not, and not one of you got a rebate for that. And I think come November 6th, people are going to say, it's time to bring our money back home to Idaho. Yes, it's going to take $42 million to draw down the $400 million, but I think the ability to find that money is there in the legislature. And in fact, if we want to have a discussion on where to go to find that, I can help Representative Anderwalda to do that.
Appreciate the help, yeah.
But again, I just think people need to understand the process, that this becomes law, and the legislature doesn't need to enact anything other than to find the funding, the 10% match for it.
Yeah, it's on.
The only thing, the legislature, in order for it not to become law, would have to act. And that's what they did with the term limits. When they overturned, then they passed a bill to overturn the referendum. So it's like Brian said, it becomes law once it's passed as a referendum, and then it's up to the legislature to, if they didn't want to, they would have to repeal it, basically.
Yeah. Well, since we've been talking about cost, one of the rallying cries of the Medicaid for Idaho campaign was that it would save money. But a recent study funded by the State Department of Health and Welfare found that it might be up for debate. The report estimates that expanding Medicaid coverage could cost taxpayers about $105 million over 10 years. But that's if counties and the states don't get rid of the catastrophic health care fund and the county indigent fund. That's about 50% funding it. Do you think that's a reasonable assumption for that report to make, Brian?
Well, if you look at the 2017-2018 numbers from the CAT fund, so both the state catastrophic health care fund and the county indigent funds, what we are paying right now is $40 million. That sounds very, very similar to what the state match would be. And we're paying $40 million through the CAT fund and indigent fund to cover 4,200 people. For the same amount of money, you can cover 62,000 people in the gap, or 91,000 up to 138% of the federal poverty level for the same amount of money. Now, I'm not an advocate for eliminating the CAT fund. I'm not an advocate for eliminating the indigent fund, but I think you will see significant savings, and a portion of that $40 million, hopefully the property taxes will be relieved from the property taxpayer, but the state portion, hopefully there's a savings there to the state that could be applied to the $40 million match that the state has to come up with.
Yeah, and I haven't heard anybody propose yet that we get rid of the CAT fund or the indigency fund, because I don't believe that this is the panacea that's going to take care of everybody, and the hospitals still aren't going to have costs. Now, I would like to get rid of them, but, you know, that's a whole different ball game. But the thing is we're getting $400 million. Is it costing us $400 million now? And I don't see that. Yeah, it's only going to we're spending 40. And I understand that we can offset some of that with this other, but it's not costing us $400 million. So if the federal government is sending us $400 million and it's saving the state $40 million, who's getting the other $360 million? Why is there that much of a gap between what the federal government is sending us and what we're saving in return on our total costs? And that's where I struggle a lot. Where's the other $360 million going?
I can answer that.
And I'm after you, Jonathan.
The way the law was set up, the Affordable Care Act provides the funding. The reason that Idaho and every other state is getting this amazing deal is that when they pass, you know, with this 10-to-1 deal, 9-to-1 deal, is that the law was set up, it raised a bunch of money. It raised taxes. I mean, there were, you know, the Affordable Care Act, when they passed it, there was an increase in taxes on high-income individuals. It cut the reimbursements to hospitals through Medicare, right? You know about that, I know. I know you were not happy about that. And there was a whole set of offsets, so that the law as a whole was designed to pay for itself, which, if you believe the Congressional Budget Office, it did. It's an if. Congressional Budget Office, they're pretty good. And the point is, it created this pot of money specifically for that purpose. That's why Idaho is being offered this deal. Now, Idaho taxpayers have paid for it already. You have your wealthy taxpayers in Idaho are paying higher taxes.
Idaho gets more back than it pays in federal taxes currently.
Well, that's a good deal.
Well, so, I mean, it's not like we're going to bring we're already bringing all our money back. We're going to bring somebody else's money in this time around.
Well, right now you're sending it to someone else.
No, we're not. We get more of it back now than what we send. We're a donor state. We get more federal dollars back than what we pay to the federal government.
Sure. No, I understand.
So if we get more federal dollars, we're going to take more money out of California, New York, Texas, and bring it into Idaho. But we're taking somebody else's dollars, not our own. We're already getting our own back.
It bothers you that you're getting money from rich people in California?
I got half of my family's in California. It really bothers me.
It does. Well, you know.
And Jonathan, that's part of the conversation is seemingly these healthcare dollars are colored differently than transportation dollars or education dollars or military dollars at Gowan Field south of here and Mountain Home Air Force Base east of here. They're colored differently than Idaho National Laboratory research dollars through the Department of Energy. They're colored differently from agricultural subsidies that farmers and ranchers rely on so heavily in this state. And so at some point, we have to be intellectually honest, and we have to either step up and say we don't want to be a recipient of all of those federal dollars, or we have to be honest with ourselves and say there are some federal programs that we will take advantage of. And some Idahoans may not like it. I don't particularly like it that there are agricultural subsidies, but I'm not a farmer or a rancher.
I'm a farmer, and I don't like it either.
Well, getting back to cost specifically, when the economy does well, fewer people need government services like Medicaid or food benefits, but how would the state pay for a sudden influx of people that might become eligible for Medicaid during the next recession, say?
That's the question that keeps me awake at night. I think the people of Idaho have already spoken in the signature gathering process. They just smashed through the very high threshold to qualify for the ballot. And again, I'm optimistic that this Proposition 2 will be successful on November 6th. What keeps me awake at night is now there is an expectation among the people of Idaho that they will have access to health care. And so for Donna and others in the state, we need to be prepared for that increased demand on health care. You asked where that other $360 million is going to go. It will go to those people who have been denied access to care and not had access to that for a period of time. So yes, you will see almost $50 million infused into our economy. It will result in 5,000 jobs being created. Those jobs will pay taxes as well. It will require us to go and recruit additional providers to provide the care.
Speaking of that, can we? Because Idaho is a very has a doctor shortage, not to mention specialist shortage.
And that has been my message around the state with all of our hospitals. We need to be prepared. We need to get on with recruiting the doctors and the nurses and the PAs and others to come to our state to be prepared to provide the care that will come. And we just can't pass this initiative. We can't just throw a bunch of money at it. We have an obligation as hospitals, and we will step up to be ready to provide that care.
Do you think it's feasible that that will be set up in time for this to be implemented? I mean, that's a pretty quick turnaround.
Certainly, and we also don't have the advantage that other states had of getting 100% federal match to stabilize that population, understand their needs, get them into some managed care. So we're behind the curveball because we made a conscious decision to kind of wait and see. I mean, we had an election in 2016. Elections have consequences. And the state said, let's wait and see what happens in 2017. And we hit the pause button, and nothing happened in 2017. And I appreciate what Jonathan said about the dynamics with the midterm election. But if there was ever a time to adjust this, I think it was in 2017, and that didn't happen. And Medicaid has continued on for 53 years with no significant changes to it other than the Affordable Care Act. And I don't see them reeling that back. Now, something may happen in 26 days nationally that proves me to be wrong on that. But the concerns that I hear from opponents to this saying, well, what if they repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act? I think the time to do that was last year, and I don't think, unless all the pundits are wrong and one of the houses doesn't shift, then I don't think we're going to be having the conversation about repeal and replace moving forward.
So we just got Idaho Sunshine Reports yesterday. As Representative Vanderwoude mentioned, Idahoans for Healthcare did raise a significant amount of money, about $500,000. Part of that was in-kind contributions from an out-of-state organization, but also significant money from people in-state as well. Meanwhile, the anti-expansion campaign raised about $30,000. Do you think this huge divide is going to translate into how it's going to play out at the ballot box?
I don't think so. I think people are pretty well educated on what the issue is. I didn't appreciate the ad that they put out saying that our money was going to other states on that one, because that's not necessarily true. But I think the people are paying enough attention now to you know, there's a couple of radio ads I've heard on against Prop 2, but there's not an organized high-dollar campaign. Whether that has much effect, I really don't know, because I think there's been enough discussion in Idaho all the way around, you know, for the last, 6-8 years, ever since the Affordable Care Act passed. It's not like nobody's ever heard of Medicaid expansion or what it is. I mean, we've been debating at the legislature virtually every year that I've been on health and welfare. And so I don't see where the dollars is going to change the results that much.
Well, and as I looked at the report too, the Idaho Hospital Association was part of, well, we were one of 300 different individuals and organizations statewide that contributed to the campaign. And I guess the question or the issue would have been if the hospitals weren't out promoting and helping and speaking about the health in our communities, then who would? I mean, that's part of our job as community hospitals, to be concerned about the community's health. And so hospitals from Boundary County, 35 miles from the Canadian border, down to Bear Lake County, have all supported this and endorsed it and have asked the Idaho Hospital Association to contribute and help in the success of its passage.
Well, we're just about at that halfway point, so I think we can start going with audience questions as soon as we get that mic around. Feel free to raise your hand if you do have a question. Again, be brief, and if you hear someone ask your question, maybe come up with a different one. Yes.
I just wanted to clear something up, because I was one of the folks who got in that green van and went all over the state. And we needed 56,192 signatures, mm-hmm. and we gathered 54,000 of those, and that was pure volunteers. So the out-of-state money that may have come in at the end, you know, maybe put us this much over the edge. But really, when we heard that was coming in, we were able to focus on the district requirement that the legislature put in.
Do you have a question, though?
Yes, I have a question. And I'm wondering, why are you willing to accept highway funds and agricultural funds from the federal government and not willing to accept funds to take care of our people?
I have some issues with some of the government subsidies in the ag business, even though I am in the ag business. I was in the dairy before. Now I farm now. But so I have some issues with the federal government being involved even in some extent on those programs. Highway dollars, we pay highway taxes that directly fund. The highway fund is a separate fund. It's not an unlimited fund like the federal budget is. And my concern is so much of how much money are we getting, and is that a good way to spend that amount of money? And I think there's a better way to spend $400 million than having the federal government control more of the health care.
We are getting the $400 million if we turn it down.
No, but if it passes, that's what we would be getting. And I just don't see that as a fiscal responsible way of spending that kind of money.
We have a question over in the corner.
I'll hold this for you. So if I understood what you said correctly, that if the people vote and pass this, then it becomes law. But then the legislature or the politicians can repeal it. In order to repeal it, does that again have to go to a vote for the people, or do they just do that themselves? And if they do, what can the people do about it?
Get mad.
You can vote them out of office, right?
Yes.
Right, yeah. It would be strictly a vote from the legislature to repeal. That's what they did with term limits. When that one passed, they repealed that referendum.
Okay. Representative, would you please talk about the cost of the plan that you would put in place as opposed to taking the $400 million? How many people would be covered by that? Where would you get those allocated funds from? Because if we have something to compare it, I think we'd like to hear about that.
Part of what I had proposed originally a couple years ago was to try to provide, starting with primary care in a lot of the rural areas and stuff like that, and they would cost somewhere around $40-50 million. It wouldn't cost $400 million, but it would cost $40-50 million, and that became a stumbling block to a lot of people also. That's statewide cost. That's state dollars that's what it would cost. And it doesn't solve all the problems, but it at least starts on that path of, I still believe that primary care is probably the biggest driver of health care costs. And until you start initializing or getting people into primary care, you're not going to really cut health care costs.
Well, and that would have covered, you know, general annual physicals and whatnot. How many people would that have covered?
The estimates probably was about 10,000 to 15,000.
And again, the challenge, as Representative said, was the cost was $40-50 million to provide just a segment of care to select individuals, 10,000 to 15,000. And for the same cost, you could draw down the federal funds and provide comprehensive coverage to 62,000 people now in Idaho who are uninsured. And so that was a stumbling block, I think. People were supportive of the concept that the representative was discussing. You know, primary care is absolutely important. It became the stumbling block when to pay for that primary care cost more than providing comprehensive care for the entire population. Accidents are still going to happen, cancer will still happen, and primary care may not address those kinds of issues that ultimately end up in the hospital. And if they're uninsured, then those costs get shifted to other taxpayers and others in the system.
If I can jump in on this, one more thing. The debate about what this cost, I mean, this is exactly the same debate that's happened in every state, how much it will cost. And, you know, and look, there's a legitimate argument. We were talking before about the quality of state accounting and state government and not knowing where your money is going. And, there's a very reasonable debate about, you know, looking at, well, you know, this is how much Idaho would have to spend and would that make up with savings? I do think it's important, and this has happened in a lot of other states, that when we talk about cost, that you realize there's a cost to the status quo. Doing nothing comes with a cost. Now, you can monetize that cost. The hospitals will gladly monetize this.
$272 million.
They'll tell you how much they're spending in uncompensated care. Now, they won't, you know, you expand Medicaid, that doesn't all go away, by the way. But some of it does. We've seen that in other states. But, you know, I was listening to Donna earlier and what she was talking about. And, you know, I've only been here 24 hours. You have a wonderful city, by the way. I'm moving here, too. I was here.
You got to find a house first.
You know, it's funny. People complain about it. No, but I interviewed two other people, and it was remarkable to me how similar their stories were, how similar it was to Donna's. And the theme here was that these were all people who had health problems and were trying to work, and their health problems were getting in the way of their work. And so they couldn't keep a job. They were not just getting, you know, there was the problem they were ending up in the emergency room and running up big healthcare costs, but they were being less productive members of society. Now, you can monetize that also. And these are people, there's money they're not making, it's income taxes they're not paying. But, you know, just in general, human misery, I mean, that has a cost too. And whether that cost is more or less, whether it's worth it, whether you could spend $400 million or $40 million better, those are all legitimate questions. But when you do the balance sheet, that should be a column there, which is, what's the cost of doing nothing?
Okay. Well, I think one of the most unique things about our campaign in Idaho, or something that really strikes me, whether unique or not, is that in a deeply red state, there does seem to be such broad bipartisan support. Our polling data indicated is that there was more support.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I just am introducing it at this point. Our polling data indicated that we had more support than any non-expansion state in the country, which is pretty extraordinary given the political makeup. So, Mr. Whitlock, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the bipartisan support for the campaign. Have there been any unusual suspects or endorsers across party lines that really demonstrate this broad support?
I'm a conservative Republican. I've worked for conservative Republicans for most of the last 30 years, two senators, a mayor, and a governor of this state. And I think my Republican credentials are pretty solid. I was a precinct committeeman who worked hard to get John Vanderwaude elected.
I'm actually his representative.
He's actually my representative. And I'm not going to run against him yet. But I think you have Republicans, and we've seen it, the chairman of the House Health and Welfare Committee, Fred Wood, has endorsed the campaign. We've had a number of Republican, both sitting legislators as well as those who've worked really hard for the last couple of years who are retiring. The people that I talk to, the people that I associate with, I think when you sit down and have a conversation about, is this the right thing to do for Idaho? I think they come to the conclusion that, yes, this will lead to better health, and yes, this will lead to a stronger economy. And I think those are two very Republican principles, at least that I've worked hard for the last 30 years. So, again, I think there has been strong bipartisan support. You saw this week, I think, that the campaign announced a number of clergy and religious leaders who've endorsed this as well. So I think it's a moral issue. I go to church on Sunday, and I get preached to that, Matthew, I read, even if you've done it under the least of these, when was I sick? When did you come unto me? Well, I'm preached that every Sunday when I go to church, and on Monday I ought to go out and practice it. And so I don't know that it's necessarily a Republican or a Democrat issue. I don't know that it's a political issue. I think it's a people issue. And we're concerned about people who, quite frankly, at this very moment, are probably sitting around dining room tables having to make very difficult decisions about whether or not they can go purchase necessary medication or put food on the table for their children. I think it's a bipartisan issue, but more than that, I think it's a human issue. It's a people issue, and I think it has broad support throughout the state.
Well, the one thing you haven't, because the Statesman didn't want to print it, is we had a list of about 29 legislators come out against Prop 2. So there is substantial amount of opposition to it too, and of those 29, I think 7 or 8 were candidates. And the others were people in the legislature. So it's a balance act even at this point yet.
I'm going to come right here, and then I'll come to you.
Okay. Hi, I have a question. On the $400 million, how do you calculate that? How do they come up with that amount of money? Is it based upon use, or is it we just give you $400 million? I don't understand on Medicaid. The state has to bill the federal government for those 90% of those funds. Are they going to bill for stuff that didn't happen? Where does that number come from?
So the Milliman Group, which is an actuarial firm that's been around for 6 decades that does all of the actuarial work for insurance providers, for the State Department of Health and Welfare, they're an international firm. And they've looked at our population. They're the ones that determined that there are about 62,000 Idahoans that fall into the gap. They also looked and said, well, there's probably another 29,000 that are somewhere between 100% of the federal poverty level and 138% of the federal poverty level who have the ability to purchase products on the health exchange, but may not be. So this would then qualify a total of 91,000 people. 62,000 uninsured, another 29,000 who have access to care, but just for some reason either can't afford it or choose not to buy a product on the health exchange, a coverage product. So, again, Milliman looked at that. They put all the numbers together. They identified the population, and it's a very intricate process to do all of that, and then they determine based on that population what the costs might be to the state, and that's where the numbers of, you know, the state would have to come up with an estimated $42 million, and then they would draw down an estimated $400 million in the first year. Over 10 years, it's about $530 million, which sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, but in return, you get $4.6 billion back from the federal government to pay for health care for people who are currently uninsured.
Hi, so I'm an RN from Ferguson, Missouri. So I've been working with the indigent most of my practice or career. And I just want to know, everyone on the panel residing in Idaho, what kind of insurance do you have? What do you have? Do you have coverage? Do you have Medicare? Do you have a private Blue Cross something? What do you have?
Blue Cross.
Blue Cross.
You've got Blue Cross. How many people here don't have any insurance? Well, is that a personal failing? Are you inferior?
Let's keep the questions to the panelists.
Okay, so seriously, why isn't it healthcare for everybody? I mean, seriously, why are we messing around with all of this?
We got to keep this to questions and not statements.
Well, that is a question.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Sorry. I'm going to come around here.
Well, and I might just offer a thought there. And in 1986... my hero, Ronald Reagan, a Republican, passed what's called EMTALA, which requires hospitals to provide care for anybody that comes in. Now, the follow-on, the logical follow-on, would be that if we're going to require every hospital across the country to provide that care, then we ought to figure out a way to pay for it. And I think that was probably the thought. We have not figured that out yet. And we still, even with Medicaid expansion, I think we'll have a handful of people who, for whatever reason, either choose to be uninsured. I was talking to a colleague from New Mexico, and they have Medicaid expansion, but, you know, they have about 3% of their population that's uninsured. So, therefore, you do need the CAT fund and the indigent fund. But, again, this is a significant step in getting to that point of providing health care coverage to all Idahoans.
Oh, thanks. My name is Lindsay Youngworth, and I'm an insurance broker here in town, and I've been working within the medical exchange since, I've been a broker for 12 years, but in the exchange since it opened in 2014. And you mentioned that if Prop 2 gets passed, that the hospital associations and the doctors associations are prepared to educate the public on how to utilize urgent and primary care services. Do you have a plan in place? Because somebody said up there, if it passes, then people will be eligible for Medicaid that month. What is that campaign going to look like, and how are we going to reach this population?
And I think there will be an educational component that will be there. And maybe working with the legislature, we can identify ways to encourage people to seek the appropriate care at the appropriate time and in the appropriate place. But under EMTALA, that federal law, we can't put a sign up in an emergency room that says, if you think you might just have a migraine, go this direction to the urgent care. But if it's an aneurysm, you need to go this direction. Because when we start to separate and diagnose people and send them in different directions, we violated EMTALA. They'll come in and take the license away and shut that community hospital down. And so there has to be an education component of that to be able to tell people to get the right kind of care at the right price and in the right place. Hospitals, I think, will be engaged in having those community conversations all across the state.
And Oregon had this concern because they were able to do a while ago, a Medicaid expansion for a portion of their population. Have you looked into what they've done to help educate that population to utilize different aspects of healthcare other than the emergency room? Because they did find that was many people's primary care, because that's the only place that they knew to go get treatment.
Yeah, I don't have to look far to Oregon. It's just right across the border, and We've had conversations with them about how they've managed and how they've been able to implement Medicaid expansion in their state.
Well, but it's going to take time to retrain people who are used to running to the emergency room to not run to the emergency room every time. Now the reason people go to the emergency room because they know that the hospital can't say no. They know that the hospital has to treat them. Otherwise, they're like the Brian said, they're going to get in trouble with the law. And so they know that. So you're going to have to retrain people basically saying, hey, you got to have a primary care physician that you need to go to. And really the hard part is even if there's no copay in emergency, but there might be a copay if you go to the doctor. And it's the reverse incentive that we really need. It should be the other way around. But because of the federal law, you can't do that. And so it's going to take a while for people to change their habits, so to speak, and not run to emergency every time and start going to primary care facilities. And that's going to take education and time. And there'll probably be more people than what we think.
Well, building off that question, Brian, I mean, what are those specific strategies? What kind of lessons have you learned maybe from Oregon's experiences with Medicaid expansion?
Don't do what Oregon did.
Education is key. Again, I think there is going to be a level of expectation once this passes in November. And so we need to help educate, and we need to provide information to Idahoans on how they can access care in the right place at the right time and at the right price. So we've got a lot of work to do. To say that we're there, we're not. I think hospitals, clinics, everybody, all providers need to step up our game to make sure that we have folks in place to provide the care, and we also need to help educate the people in a way that they will seek the appropriate care in the right place at the right time. And then we all save money that way.
So I'm a finance guy by training and at the heart of it. And in finance, like in engineering, you kind of have to ask a question before you get to all this, which is what we're paying for working? So in the United States, 87% of our money is spent on chronic care. It's chronic because whatever's done doesn't fix the problem. So I would like to assert that the issue isn't really expanding Medicaid. You're talking about creating a structure of financing something that doesn't work very well now. That's really the heart and soul of the problem, because as a business matter and as a finance matter, you always want to be able to allocate your capital efficiently and effectively. We don't have a system set up to do that. It was never set up to do that, because we don't capture the data. How would you imagine capturing data on medicine that works?
Idaho is a data poor state. We don't gather discharge data from hospitals. We don't have an all-payer claims database. About all we can do is look retrospectively at a Medicare cost report from last year to know where we spend our money and how effective we are in treating some of these chronic conditions.
Without capturing outcomes data, that's almost irrelevant. You would agree.
Yeah.
So we have to get to that.
Right.
And how do we get to that point?
Stay tuned. we'll be visiting with our friends in the legislature about that, and I think even the Department of Insurance is utilizing some grant money and looking at how we capture the data.
Well, and I think somewhere along the line, you know, Obamacare was put out and put in place to try to control health care costs. It didn't do it. Everybody's still the real look at what health care really costs and how do you get that cost down has never really been done. And I think that's a key. That still is. You know, it's not whether it's $400 million or what do you pay the hospital or what the insurance pays. It's what is it costing, and how do we get our healthcare costs down to something more reasonable? But that's a different discussion than Medicaid expansion. But Medicaid expansion adds to the system we now have, which is failing. I believe the system we now have is failing in controlling the cost of what we have to pay. And a prime example of that is my wife had surgery, and she saw the bill from the hospital, and she called them up and said, hey, I didn't have this, I didn't have that. Oh, okay, we'll take that off. And then they said, well, why are you worried about it? The insurance is going to pay for it. And there's a disconnect between the service we get and who's paying for it. And until you connect those two back up, you're not going to control some of the health care costs. But that's a different debate.
Well, I'll just keep it going, because my question was, do we have data from states that expanded Medicaid, and how did that impact health care costs in those states? I understand that there's a lot stacked up there because you're going to bring more people into the system. So just by the numbers, there's going to be more. And then my other question is related to that. I just left friends who are small business people, and they're paying for two people out of pocket $22,000+ a year for their health insurance premiums. That's not counting their deductibles or their co-pays. I did the numbers myself. If I were to leave my job, go start a business as I'd like to do, my premiums were going to run for myself and my child about $15,000 a year. And then there was going to be a $7,000 deductible for each of us, plus our co-pays until we hit our max. So if we do the Medicaid expansion in Idaho, how is that, do we know if that's going to have some sort of an impact on my friends that are paying the $22,000 and myself, who would be paying out of pocket? I'd be like $28,000, $29,000 a year out before insurance took over.
Two parts of that question, I'm going to answer it, I think. Tell me. So there's first the question about how the experience of other states on Medicaid expansion. It's 34 different stories. Every state's a little different. In some states, they've had some surprises. They had more people sign up than they thought. What I tend to think the most honest way to look at the program as a whole to say, the Affordable Care Act nationally, what's it costing relative to what they thought it was going to cost? And it's coming in right around where they thought. I mean, that's roughly the budget. So, there's going to be variation from state to state. But in general, I think the Medicaid expansion is neither adding to nor reducing the overall, cost. It is basically getting people insurance within this system. And I think it's costing, what they thought it was going to cost roughly, given the way that system was set up. Now, the second part of your question is about why is my insurance so expensive? Or no, why is it...
the second part is, if we bring more people into the system, are we showing anywhere, somewhere in the other states where they expanded Medicaid, that by improving health care overall, did insurance premiums drop health care costs?
Okay, so... There is actually data that in states where they expanded Medicaid, it actually put downward pressure on the price of insurance for people buying on their own. And the reason was, I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but in general, with the people buying private health insurance, with the Affordable Care Act exchanges that were set up, the whole game is getting enough healthy people and getting a good risk balance. In states where they expanded Medicaid, the Medicaid expansion tended to absorb a lot of the people who had high medical costs, took them off the exchange in effect. And that meant that insurance prices came down. Now, I don't want to exaggerate the effect. It's not like it had a huge impact. But there is data to suggest that if the states that expanded Medicaid did better on insurance premiums than other states. It's still really expensive in those states. And there's a whole other discussion about how you get that down. And, that's a separate discussion. Yeah. But in general, to the extent there's a correlation, if you expanded Medicaid, you tended to do a little better on private insurance premiums. Not a lot, but a little.
I would like to see that data, because I haven't seen any data that looks like that. Because we've seen on the exchange where you're talking, 20 to 40% premium increases nationwide and even in states that expanded. So I don't know where you're seeing the downward pressure on insurance. And even Idaho, with the Affordable Care Act, our premiums have gone way up, too. And so I have not seen data that shows that the premiums of the states that have expanded are lower than the states that haven't.
So I can send you the email. I can email it to you. Okay. There's been actual
peer review. I would like to see that.
There's not. I mean, basically, did the premiums come down? No. You look at how much they went up in these states.
The increase
how
was
much
less.
They went up. The increase was less. So the effect of the Medicaid expansion was to moderate the premium increases. Again, I don't want to oversell the impact here. It was not huge, but there was a correlation.
So the Kaiser Family Foundation did a study that found that on average, premiums were about 7% lower in expansion states than non-expansion states. And again, you don't have to look too far. I talked to somebody the other day who had gone out on the Washington Exchange to compare what a product on the Washington Exchange for a 40-year-old male non-smoker was, and it was 20% less than in Idaho. You show me anything in Washington State that's cheaper than Idaho, everything's more expensive there, except they've expanded Medicaid. I think more people are in the pool for coverage, and it's had that downward pressure to where it's 20% lower.
But is that also because Washington has a higher population than Idaho, and the risk pool could be a little bit broader in terms of more catastrophic care that they might cover?
Is that for me or Jonathan?
Since you were talking about Washington State.
I don't know the reason why. I think it's because of expansion. I think it's because they have broader coverage and more people in the pool. I think it has created that downward pressure. But again, just get on the internet tonight and search for a product in Washington on their exchange and compare it to a product in Idaho. And search for a product in Oregon compared to a product in Idaho. Again, the Kaiser Family Foundation found that it was about 7% on average cheaper.
Yeah, and it could be both factors. I mean, I think it's entirely possible it's both. I think, in general, if you look at the states where the exchanges where insurance tends to be cheaper, there's no hardening. There's about 10 different factors, but, demographics are a big part of it. In general, more urban, more dense states have an easier time than more rural states because it's just harder to get them. Yeah, there's no question about that. But, another factor turns out it looks like is the Medicaid expansion. So, on the list of things that will help or hurt, you would put Medicaid expansion as helping. Again, I don't want to exaggerate the impact here. It's a small impact, but that's what you got.
Okay, thank you. I think there are some similarities between Idaho, Washington, and Oregon, and that there are a lot of rural hospitals in those three states. And so you've got a couple of states that have embraced this, and we're looking at it. So what's the future in those three states under the current law for rural hospitals? I know we're losing rural hospitals, are we not?
We are. Nationwide, you've seen a number of closures, and we have 27 what are called critical access hospitals or rural hospitals in Idaho, which are licensed for 25 or fewer beds. So in some communities, they may only have 3 or 4 beds, and in other communities like Moscow, they may have 25 beds that they're utilizing. But these are critical access hospitals. Let me give you an example. Salmon, Idaho. If you're floating the Salmon River and you have an accident and you need health care, you're going to go to Steele Memorial Hospital, which is a critical access hospital. And if that hospital were closed, you would drive 168 miles to the next tertiary hospital in Idaho Falls. So you'll go to Steele Memorial, you'll get stabilized, and then if you need to, you'll get transferred to Eastern Idaho Regional Medical Center in Idaho Falls. So what happens if that hospital closes? I can tell you of the 27 critical access hospitals that we have in Idaho, 19 of them are operating at zero margin or less. Now, how many businesses can you run where you operate on zero margin?
The federal government.
Federal government.
Well, how many of those hospitals are also nonprofit, too?
And those are county and district hospitals as well. So those county taxpayers end up writing a check to help cover some of the operating costs that they lose. If you go to Grangeville, Idaho, their uncompensated care is seven figures. If you go a little farther to Orofino, $2 million in uncompensated care in that little community. So, I'm worried. I'm really worried about 19 of those 27 critical access hospitals. A recent study indicated that because of Medicaid expansion, those states that have expanded Medicaid have seen fewer closures in their rural hospitals. So, again, I'm out working really hard to keep access to critical care in rural Idaho communities, and I think we can do that by eliminating a portion of the uncompensated care that each of these critical access hospitals are seeing.
I got a quick question for you. I've always, all the meetings I go to, they tell me that the Medicaid reimbursement rate is so low I can't make any money. So how does that help the critical care hospitals?
So let me give you a scenario. You provide a service to me for free, okay? You get no compensation.
You're
for it.
Really asking a lot.
I know. So,
but being I'm your representative, I would do that.
But you get zero compensation for that. Right. Or I come to you and say, I'll give you 84 cents on your cost. Which loss would you take? 84 cents, or would you take zero? And with uninsured people coming in, we really are faced with a choice of, in rural hospitals, do we continue to take zero reimbursement for the care that we're providing in those rural communities, or do we take 84 cents? And I will tell you that all 19 of those in a heartbeat would say, we'll take 84 cents over zero.
We have a question over here.
So just looking at a different aspect, and it sounds like I realize we're talking about low-income people, but me, my husband, and many of my friends talk about retirement and how we can't retire for 5 to 10 years because we have no health insurance. And so, excuse my ignorance, but is this gap, where is the monetary level of this gap? Is it so low that retirees can't take advantage of it? Or, so that's my question.
So the gap is comprised of Idahoans who make too much to qualify for Medicaid, which for an individual would be $4,380. If you make $4,381, you don't qualify for Medicaid. Or you make too little, meaning about $12,000 for an individual, you make too little to qualify for a subsidy on the exchange. So the gap is somewhere between $4,380 and $12,160. If you fall into that income range as an individual, you don't have access to healthcare, affordable healthcare coverage. Let me give you an example. I have a 26-year-old son. He just aged off of my policy, my plan. He's going to medical school right now in Moscow, Idaho. He is studying to be a doctor. He will pay lots and lots of taxes to this state in a few years. But because he aged off of my plan, and because he's not working, and because he's borrowing hundreds of thousands of dollars to fund his medical education, he is going to be in this gap unless Dad steps forward and pays his COBRA for the next 36 months, which I will probably do, because if he has a medical catastrophe that happens to him, suddenly he would end up having to worry about how to pay for that medical catastrophic incident, and he would get totally sidelined on his future and his plans and his career. And so what we're talking about with those 62,000 people are people who are working, people who are trying to contribute, people who want to better themselves. And the nice thing is about Medicaid expansion, when they hit that income level, they'll be able to move on to the exchange and purchase a product. What they won't have to do is worry about how they're going to cover their medical expenses while they're trying to get to that point.
It looks like we have time for about one or two more questions.
I'm going to take one from over here. And I'm only going to come to people who haven't already asked a question, just so you know. I think can we squeeze in three so I can get
we
these
be
two
able
and
to.
I can get one
yeah.
over here? Okay. Thank you.
So few here would argue that our system is not broken. 25-30%. Like this lady, no health care. The rest of us cannot understand our bills. My wife has a health care management degree. The rest of us cannot. I think we're at eighth or ninth in the world in life expectancy, yet we spend the most for health care, in the world per capita. It doesn't work. The rest of the developed world, every other Western nation in the world, has universal health care. My question for the representative is, why is the rest of the world wrong? And we're right in a system that clearly does not work. Why?
Well, part of it is trying to figure out how you pay for it. Now, the other countries have taxed people enough to pay for the universal health care. And so they have figured out a way to pay for it. But I think most of our health care costs come as we do a lot more research than most other countries do.
In terms of what kind of research?
The medical research. I think a lot of the stuff comes out of here. But at the same token, I don't understand why we have a law that says you can't buy your drugs out of Canada. That's right. When it's way cheaper. Why would we put that type of law into place? If the same drug that you can buy here costs, you know, 20% of in Canada, why can't we? But we have a law that says you can't. Why? I don't know.
Homegrown pharmaceutical companies.
That's probably a big part of it. Yep.
So I participated in the grassroots signature collection, and I continue to educate voters on Medicaid expansion, including some guy I just met at the grocery store, because for me, this is about changing the quality of life for individual Idahoans. And so I want to ask each of you if you can recall or think of a person that falls into this gap, and how can you see expanding Medicaid benefiting that individual?
I mentioned my son, so there's one example. He's his wife. He just got married in June. She quit her job in Utah to marry him and move to Moscow, Idaho for medical school. I will tell you the mental stress that she's under right now as a childbearing age young woman trying to figure out, okay, I've got to get a job that has insurance. So I have a son and his new bride who are struggling with the emotional issue of how do we get coverage, and how do they're scared to walk out of their apartment for fear of something happening and derailing their hopes and their dreams. And if there was something that would give them the ability to have access to healthcare coverage, they'll continue to work hard. She'll continue to work to find a job that has healthcare coverage. They will be productive citizens of Moscow and Latah County and the state of Idaho, and they will pay lots of taxes in the future. But they're at a point right now where they're scared. And I think we need to do something about that.
We only have about 5 more minutes, so
I'm going to ask Donna a question really
yes,
quickly.
Yes, please.
Donna, it's amazing that you're here sharing your experience with us. I think I speak for all of us. Just so much gratitude for that. And a bunch of us who work together are slacking. We all wanted to ask you this question, sort of, what would your advice be to people who are in the gap? How did you get through that to be here with us?
Mostly my family. It's been harder on all of us. It really has. Number one, because it is undiagnosed. As I said, we don't know the prognosis. We don't know anything. And as we watch this disease progress, it's been a huge anxiety on my kids, on myself. I never dreamed I'd be in this position. As I said, I worked since I was 14 years old. I raised my kids. They were military. I am a Republican. I never dreamed this would happen to me. And when it does happen to you, and you continue to try and work for a while, and then you get asked to leave, you've depleted all of your savings. You've depleted everything. Trying to pay medical bills while you were working, even. I haven't told a lot of people this, but I also had to file bankruptcy. I had a $5,000 deductible the first year, $6,000 the second year, put off on disability the third year. How do I pay for all that? I also had to file a medical bankruptcy. It plays havoc on your health. I know a lot. Some health issues I'm having now, I've never, before this happened to me, I never had high blood pressure. I never had high cholesterol. Doctors were shocked when I'd go in and they'd say, "You're not on any medication?" No, I was very, very healthy. And this can take over your whole life. I don't get the exercise as much now because I get muscle cramps constantly. I have to stop. So then I become sedentary, which is not healthy. You know, so this has affected my whole family. And the anxiety is overwhelming. That's and then the personal end of it is, as you can tell, I can't control these seizures. I go into a grocery store, and immediately, you know, they start happening. Should we call 911? You know, do we? You know, it looks like I'm having a stroke. I have to try and speak with my face falling off. That no, I'm okay. Please don't call anybody. You know, I just need to sit down and get through this. It's scary, and it's. I'm just thankful I had my kids.
Donna, I could ask you one question. You stated earlier that once you were diagnosed as disability, it took how long before you actually could collect any disability? Didn't you say it was like a year and a half or whatever before
no.
you could
when
collect?
When I was put on Social Security disability, right. I have a 6-month waiting period.
Six. And what's the logic behind that?
I have no idea. Praise God again. My son did a GoFundMe. Because I had absolutely no income for 6 months.
Yeah.
They said you can't work, but there's a 6-month federal waiting period. It's federally mandated. Then after you get your Social Security disability, you cannot have Medicare for 2.5 years. So
and what's the logic on that one?
I'm
hearing that. It just makes no sense.
It doesn't. I agree. Because I was told you'll get Medicare in 2 years. Go to Medicaid. Go to health and welfare. You'll get Medicaid. Not the case. Sorry, you make too much money for Medicaid on disability.
Okay.
So then 2 years was up. I was all excited. This would have been May. And I'm all excited. I go down to Social Security. I say, I'm ready for my Medicare. I need to see a physician. I need to see a neurosurgeon or a neurologist. And they're like, oh, well, just like SSD, you do have the 2-year waiting period, but now you also have the 6-month waiting period.
Yeah,
I left there crying. I was floored. I was flabbergasted.
I would be too, I would think. Yep.
How can I keep going through this and not see a doctor?
Yeah.
Looks like we have one more.
I think we're good.
You think we're good? Okay. Well, again, I want to thank our entire panel for being here tonight. Obviously, we have Jonathan Cohn from HuffPost. We have Representative John Vanderwoude from NAMPA, if I remember correctly. Is that correct? Yes. Brian Whitlock, president of the Idaho Health Hospital Association, and Donna Scranton. And again, a big thank you to the audience for coming here tonight and taking time out of your busy schedule, especially as we go back into school time and people kind of coming back from summer vacation. And a big thank you to HuffPost for being such a wonderful collaborator in this panel and helping us put this discussion on and including us on their Listen to America tour. And of course, our volunteers from Boise State Public Radio, can't say enough about them and everyone at the office. So remember, as we said at the top of this, Election Day is November 6th, not just for Proposition 2, but also for some big offices, new governor in the state of Idaho, first time in 12 years. And also the entire state legislature. So thank you and have a good night.